You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Emily Sugihara, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here.
Returning champion, you were on the show episode 30 a year and a half ago, November 2017. It's kind of crazy how time flies.
Yeah. It was the longest, shortest year of my life.
The longest, shortest year of your life. What does that mean?
So last time we talked, we were, I think, midway through a long plan to unify our team into a single location.
Because you had people in New York and people in San Francisco.
Yeah, we were split for 5 years. All the like creative team was in San Francisco. And the sales team was in New York.
Got it.
And, you know, other teams were kind of like split between the two. Yeah, as we got bigger and as you grow, you kind of add complexity to the business in many ways. The communication just got really, really difficult. It felt like we were doing a lot of things because we had done them before. And like a change in process involved too much communication. And there was like a lot of friction in our communication. So we made kind of like the hard decision to close that office and relocate everything to San Francisco. We relocated like about a third of the people there. We gave almost everybody the option to relocate, but we knew a move across the country is a big ask. So some people came and some people found other stuff and stayed in New York. And we did this kind of like incredible hiring push. We like more than doubled the number of people like in the San Francisco office in the span of a year. And yeah, it totally felt like a wild ride.
So if people want to like hear a little bit about the preceding events to that, we talked a little bit about it in our last episode, and we won't go into the whole story of Bagu again, just kind of focus on maybe the last year and a half and some of the challenges there, as well as like all the new products and initiatives that you've launched since then. With this hiring thing, it just reminds me of, I think I was listening to an interview of the founder of Slack, and their company, I think, went through a transition where over the course of a year, they went from like 400 to 1600 people or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I can't even conceptualize that, like not even remotely.
And the year before that, they had gone from like 100 to 400. And, you know, at Lumi, we're just under 50 at the moment.
Uh-huh. You guys doubled in the last 18 months, right?
Roughly, yeah, yeah. So I have so much more appreciation for what you were struggling with. And I have no concept of how Slack did what they did. I mean, that's totally nuts. With the growth of your team, has it been across all of the different divisions of the company? Or has it been more operational, more product, more marketing? Where are these new people falling into?
Yeah, so we're really focused and have been for the last few years on our direct business. So teams that support that, like Bagu.com, and we actually have a great Amazon business. So teams that are supporting the direct channels have definitely seen the most growth. And then our operations team has to grow kind of in tandem with,
sure,
with all the revenue teams to sort of deal with, you know, actually making all those bags and getting them to people. And we were operating with a super, super lean creative team for a long time. And a few years ago when we decided we want to kind of put all of our energy into making the product and the branding more exciting and the best it could be, a lot of that just meant like adding a few more people so we have time to make like, you know, 10 prototypes instead of only 5 to like get a certain style just right. Or so that we have like more people on the production team who can, I mean, just the project of going out and finding the perfect recycled ripstop nylon for us was this like kind of huge venture for our production team. That when you staff super lean so that like everyone is fully occupied just like getting the product in on time, you don't have time for like kind of long-term thinking and improvements. So
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. We're always playing around with like exactly what the right level is. Because adding more people also just like adds more complexity.
What have you figured out from a communication standpoint to help make that complexity less overwhelming?
This is going to sound really corporate again. But we started doing OKRs,
mm-hmm,
where we just do them on a team level. And so every team does quarterly OKRs. And the like leadership team meets and reviews them and talks through them. And then all the team leaders like share them with their team. But that exercise has been hugely important for helping everybody kind of like prioritize and work towards the same goal. And now everybody on all the different teams, from like B2B sales to the like product designers, like everybody kind of at a high level knows what the other teams are working on and what kind of their most important deliverables are.
Do you use any tools to manage that?
You know, we tried one that we ended up abandoning, and we are in a Google Doc.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we have a Google spreadsheet with all of the team OKRs, and they're like, you know, the little drop downs where you grade them. And it's public to the whole company, so everyone can see it. We're like a really diehard Asana company.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we've been using Asana for like 7 years.
And that works well for you?
Yeah, it's incredible. I'm also getting paid to say this. No, I'm kidding. yeah, Asana comp us a couple months. No, but they like our systems and all of our communication like revolves a lot around Asana. So people can be followers on the like grading the monthly OKRs task, and then they'll get an alert when like everybody's graded theirs and they can log in and look at it.
Hmm.
Like kind of as part of the reorg and the transition, we started doing OKRs, which has been great. And we also wrote down AORs, areas of responsibility. So there is a single Google Doc with everybody's name, everybody's job, and like kind of between like 3 to 8 bullet points of what are their areas of responsibility. And that has been really huge for, I think it gives everybody kind of like a language to come back to in terms of when you're like, I want to hire someone else for my team. It's like, okay, like what would their AORs be? And how does that change other people's AORs? We were never consistent about keeping people with up-to-date job descriptions. Like you had one when you were hired and then it kind of like morphed from there.
Yeah.
And there are people who had been at Begu for 8 years and like really didn't have a job description. But the AORs is kind of like a light enough format and everybody's on the same page and it's public to everyone. So that as we grow and add seats and people's responsibilities like change and shift and we add new things we do, we have this like, you know, written document of like how this is supposed to go.
Is that something that you learned from books or just reading online, or what was it that led you? Because OKRs, AORs, KPIs, there's all these acronyms.
I know,
like people
kind
of use those. And by the way, I'm like nodding along because we've implemented a lot of those types of things, you know, on our side as well over the past year.
Yeah, the transition from like 20 to 40 is like basically putting in internal infrastructure, where like everyone can't just know everything anymore.
Were there mentors or things that you looked at that helped you with that process of implementing it?
You know, I would really like to have a mentor. I haven't found one. That's like always been kind of on this weird thing where I'm like, I feel like I should find a mentor. But yeah, one has not appeared to me. And I don't know exactly what my actionable is in getting one. If you're out there, please email me. But my husband, who runs a tech startup, got a CEO coach who wrote this like secret book that's a 90-page Google Doc.
Wait a minute. I've seen this thing.
You have?
I've seen this Google Doc. Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. Wait, what is it called? Like From Founder to CEO or something?
Yes. Matt's book.
Okay. I need to look this up. I think it got posted online like a few months ago.
It was probably on Hacker News or something.
Okay. We're going to put a link to this. Keep going.
Okay. That's cool. I'm glad that it's public. Okay. Anyways, Matt's book was a big one for me.
The great CEO Within is the
book.
Okay. Matt Mockery?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Cool. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. That one was huge. And then, I don't know, I read a ton and I get really excited about what I read and I buy like 12 copies and make everybody else read it. So, yeah, I feel like last year, like, everybody read Radical Candor.
Right.
Everybody read Measure What Matters. 1 Minute Manager has always been a big one at Begu, getting things done. I don't know. There's, like, a whole tome of all of the, like, greatest hits of, like, weird management books.
That's great, though. I feel like, compiling the library of all that stuff. Because it is cool that we live in a time where you can literally, you're trying to build a business, you can Google some of this stuff.
Like it seems totally.
Like high-level strategic problem. Let me just look it up on Google.
I know. I'll just like read Harvard Business Review, and it's all there. There's an Asana project called BMARG, Business Management Reading Group.
Okay.
It's kind of a joke how corporate the acronym is. You can choose to follow it or not follow it. But if you follow it, like people post kind of interesting articles that they've read that relate to Bagu. We have a real internal culture of like learning through reading and sharing it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think we've been doing a little bit of that at Lumi. Jesse, my co-founder, is a huge reader. I'm a lot slower than she is, but I feel like I get the cliff notes from her. Like I'll just take her out to breakfast and then she gives me the short version of it. So that's my way of reading a lot of books.
Like, hey, Jesse, give me Radical Candor, please.
Sometimes I will just give her books that I want to read so that she does all the reading and then she just gives me the short version. It's great. It works really well. We have some people who've been with us for now 5 or 6 years, and it's a diminishing proportion constantly, like no matter what you do, of like people who have that like historical context. What were some of the challenges that you were dealing with just on that side when you were bringing new people in?
Well, okay, we have someone wonderful named Ben who runs People Ops and Space Ops. So the day that Ben and his people put in all of the new desks was the day that it was like, oh man, like this is real. You get like kind of this like physical sense of like what it's going to be like with all these people here. And I went into this kind of like panic about like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, our ratio of like people who kind of live and breathe Bagu and know what's going on to like new people who don't know anything is going to be really different than it's ever been before. And how can we keep our culture and keep the like kind of really essence of Bagu true in the office with this huge influx of new people? So we spent the time which is crazy because I feel like we should have done this years ago, but we spent the time last year to actually write down values. Like we hadn't done stuff like that before because it just seemed like, well, it's like a weird corporate thing to do. But no, it's been incredibly powerful. And I feel like we did actually a great job of really integrating the values in the everyday conversation at Bagu. And they're used in like performance management and like, I don't know, like we wanted to be able to push more decision-making down to everybody and having this like concrete set of values to come back to when making choices, I think has like empowered everybody at Bagu.
Oh, wow. This is great because I pulled up the 5 values that we test for in our hiring process for Lumi. I'm wondering if there's overlap.
Yeah, I'm really curious about yours. Okay. So ours are do the right thing. That's our attitude towards customer service. That's our attitude towards our employees, is like we generally all try to be good people. So that like felt really true to us. Professionalism, you're on time, present, and prepared. I think like the bigger the company gets, the more kind of appreciative of professionalism we all are. It just makes everything run nicely. Openness, so people being flexible and adaptable to change, especially in a growing company, that's been huge. One of ours is make things delightful. So you believe in the importance of good aesthetics and that there's value in taking a little bit of extra time to make something look great. So in addition to writing down our like corporate values, we wrote down our product values, which are function, value, longevity, and delight. And those are kind of like the 4 important things that all good Bagu products have. And looking back on the history of everything we've made, not everything could speak to all 4 of those things, but everything good could.
Wow. So that was make things delightful kind of has its sub kind of like 4 components to it.
I think I digressed. the subcomponents are our product values.
They're product values.
So that's like what we think about when we're like designing the stuff we make. And the product values and the corporate values are like obviously intertwined. Like you can't make stuff if you don't believe in what you're making.
Yeah.
Or you can. You can't make good stuff if you don't believe in what you're making.
Mm.
But yeah. So.
Wait, I think we only got through the 4. Do the right thing, professionalism, openness, and make things delightful. What's the 5th one?
The 5th one is think long-term.
Ooh.
That's kind of where we put in all of our sustainability stuff.
Yeah.
Which is like, think about your long-term impact on the planet. And also the way we make kind of a lot of financial decisions and business decisions. We're not, you know, I don't have to do a quarterly earnings call with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe this is it. But yeah, it's like we're able to kind of like invest in the long-term health of the brand, which feels good.
This is great. We approached things differently at Lumi. We haven't actually come up with like the company-wide values yet. I think we've been coalescing a lot of different things. The thing that we did do is create a set of values. It's sort of like overlaps with what you have here that we're looking for any new person that we would add to the team. And the way that we think of them is like, here are the five things that we're not going to teach you. Like, because we do a lot of training at Lumi for people who join, and it really depends on what team you join. If you're joining the engineering team, we use a lot of weird programming languages, actually. So we might teach you about those programming languages. Obviously, we have a lot of packaging and supply chain knowledge that is important that we try to train everybody on. But there's a handful of things that we're actively saying, we want you to bring that with you because we think they're just important to be a successful like human being at Lumi. And some of them are really similar to what you have. The five that we have are curiosity, communication, empathy, work ethic, and good taste.
Yeah.
Like some of them are kind of the same thing. So like work ethic is sort of similar to professionalism. We just want, you know, people to come in and be, you know, professional and do things on time, that kind of stuff.
I know, which seems kind of like duh, of course. But actually, like, no, that is not how everyone operates. And we want it to be very clear that that's how we want to operate, like, at our company.
Yeah. Good taste, I think, is sort of like making things delightful. Do the right thing is maybe sort of empathy-ish. We think long-term is a really great one. That one, I think, we've been talking about something like that as well, but it's more... Yeah, like high level company wide. I think that is actually something that we would be willing to train people on. I think that's not necessarily the mindset that society promotes, I guess. So I think it is something that you kind of have to like build up and train people on.
I read that book Principles by Ray Dalio. And
I haven't read it.
It's good. He talked a lot about how they do hiring. But he differentiated between kind of like skills and attributes.
Okay.
And attributes are things that are kind of fixed in you. And like you can get, it's like being detail oriented. Like you can get a little bit better with training, but if you don't have that kind of like internal wiring, you're never going to be incredible at it. So when we're hiring for a job, we try to break down like what are kind of the like intrinsic parts of the person that we need to look for that have to already exist.
Yeah.
And then what is, you know, just skills and knowledge that like we can teach you when you get here.
Yeah. And something that I picked up from the CEO of Stitch Fix, Katrina Lake, is there's this like meme or meme in like the dictionary version of the word of like culture fit is this idea that a lot of people within recruiting think about. And at Stitch Fix, I remember her mentioning that she had changed that to culture add rather than culture fit.
That's cool.
To kind of incorporate the idea that, you know, if you have these values, you need to make the distinction between finding more people who look like you or feel like you and think about people who match those values but maybe come from a very different background. And that kind of changes your frame of mind around it a little bit.
Yeah. Having different types of people is like awesome and really important.
So those five things that you highlighted, how have they expressed themselves in, I don't know, your hiring or your approach to like training all these new people who have joined?
Well, I think it gave everyone a shared language to talk about what is like what we want. And what is good. So we use them as part of our kind of like, we have like a very light ongoing performance management system. But like when we're doing reviews, it's like one of the questions in the 360 review is, can you give a couple examples of how this person embodied values and a couple of examples of times when they struggled to embody a value. And that actually is the opening for kind of like, I don't know, it's like everything can sort of come back to the values.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think I come from a similar school of thought where it's like, oh man, all of this feels so like corporate-y or something like that to add these processes.
I know, yeah. It was like hard to like jump over that hump.
But it's true that eventually, and I think that is the struggle of when you reach a certain critical mass of people, it's hard to find a way for everyone to have the same language. And even if you have this like intrinsic or like this sense that is just a feeling in your body of something feels good or something doesn't feel good, if you can't describe in what way it feels good or not, then everything just becomes like a pseudoscience or something. It just becomes like...
Yeah, yeah. You have these like really vague conversations with people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like it helped us be sort of like concrete with what it is that we actually want and appreciate in employees.
Was there any pushback from people who had been around for a longer time about like, hey, why are we doing this? Is this like worthwhile?
No, I actually think... I was surprised. Like, I feel like we got the most pushback from like the back of my brain being like, oh man, like you guys are so corporate now. Like, what are you doing? But actually, no, with the long-term crew, coming up with this was like a very collaborative process. Ellen, who is our creative director, who has worked on Bagu with me since the beginning, and I did the first draft together. And then the two of us shared everything with the leadership team. And there was like, it took us a couple months to get through. There was a lot of debate and editing to come up with sort of like what was the essence of Bagu. But I feel like because there was so much involvement, there was like a high level of buy-in from everybody. I also think we picked stuff that just like is true. And yes, the people who do that stuff are the people who historically have gotten promoted the fastest. The people who don't do this stuff are the people who like haven't worked out. So I don't know. It seemed kind of authentic to us.
And are you still in the midst of this growth period or have things stabilized a little bit?
I'd say we're like still in the midst of growth, but we are no longer in the midst of transition.
Hmm.
Yeah. The like last day of that office was at the end of April and everyone is in San Francisco. All of the open positions from that transition have been filled. As part of this, we ended up kind of reorganizing the corporate structure of the whole company. And I feel like we're in a really good place. The teams are set. People know what they're supposed to be doing. Our theme for this year is mastery. Like last year was kind of like figuring out new things. And this year is like, how can we really like dig into what we're doing and get really good at all of the new things we do?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. This is bringing back to the conversation that we had last time. The Japanese word for craftsmanship. What's that? I'm thinking of a word, but you know.
You have wabi-sabi.
No, not wabi-sabi, but like, okay, it's going to come back to me. But that, to me, at the end of the last episode, I was just selfishly asking you for tips about what I should do when I go to Japan because it was my first time going there.
Oh, yeah. How was your trip?
It was amazing.
It was like another lifetime ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago now, but I think about it all the time. It's like a place that I can go in my mind. When I think about mastery, I think about Japanese culture.
Yes. The like attitude towards mastery there is amazing. Yeah, we're not quite like you can only make rice for 10 years.
Rice. You can only do Instagram for 10 years and then maybe.
Oh, no. Instagram is a high level skill.
Yeah. You could.
We wouldn't let you practice on Instagram.
I'm trying to figure out what the equivalent would be for you.
Yeah. Data entry. No, we've automated most of it. Yeah, that's funny.
So mastery is about taking some of the things that you've done and trying to get better at them. Is that across the board, like operationally, product development, all of the things?
Yeah. I think part of this transition was also us kind of like looking inward and being like, who are we and who do we want to be? We started doing that as a creative team. I think a couple of years ago. So we develop about a year in advance. So the stuff you saw in 2018 was all like the work we did in 2017. So yeah, we had this kind of like, I feel like we had like a new creative renaissance and freedom starting around 2017. And we decided to really focus on our direct business and worry less about what a few of our large wholesale accounts thought, which I feel like we were getting a little bit conservative because we were catering too much to that. And yeah, our designs got weirder and I think better and connected more with our customers. And I don't know. I think there was like a little bit of more freedom in the brand last year that you'll see continuing on to this year.
Well, you've expanded into new categories like umbrellas and fanny packs and more leather goods and stuff that were...
That fanny pack is one of the best bags we make. Do you have one?
I don't have
one. would you like one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want black or a weird color?
I need to look at your weird colors.
Okay. Yeah, tell me what color you want.
I'm looking at...
I'm really proud of that bag.
The other thing that I thought was so cool I haven't seen before is the 3D... What do you call it again? The 3D bag?
Oh, 3D zips.
3D zips. I thought that one was really cool looking.
Yeah.
I don't think the colors are up my alley personally for the 3D zips.
That's really good feedback. Thank you. we do new colors every few months. We'll drop new colors. So it changes out all the time.
Yeah.
But we're like trying to figure out what the relationship is between like core and seasonal.
Yeah.
Like what do we always want to have so that you know anytime you want like, a, you know, a Sailor Stripe standard bagu, you can get it on our website.
Right. I'm looking at the fanny pack right now. We'll put some images in the show notes. The thing cool. That is so cool, it's got the like, I don't know, you see this, I guess it's the strap has the big bagu wording
logo
on it.
Strap.
Yeah, it's cool. Are these zippers Thanks. Like Riri zippers? They're like fancy zippers.
They're really nice zippers.
Yeah.
I think they're Visalon.
Those are very chunky. So that was something, what else was weird about or weirder? What are the different things from a product design standpoint that you're really proud of?
Our print lineup for all of last year and all of this year, I'm so stoked about. The prints have gotten much more exciting. I think that's where we've like truly gotten weird with the standard bagu prints. I think there's stuff that like we would have been nervous about, like, are we going to actually be able to sell this? That we're like, yeah, we can sell this.
And what pushed you over the edge? Was that something that you were asking for, or was that something else, somebody else was empowered to?
I think as part of our like kind of like internal investigation, we honed in on the like function, value, longevity, and delight. Like I think for prints, delight was huge. Like looking back on our prints, the ones that sold the best were the ones where you just like loved it. And it was like this thing that you wanted to have with you all the time. And yeah, I think also like realizing that like we were our target customers, which I guess on some level we've always known, but actually saying that out loud. So like if we as the designers don't think this is cool, we shouldn't make it.
Mm.
There was stuff like looking back over the years, there was stuff we made because we were like, well, I don't know. I don't love this, but like I think people will buy it. And that always led us to bad decisions. And when there's stuff that like we truly love, we've been carrying the samples, like we think it's a really good product, we actually are pretty good representatives of our customer base. It's kind of like trusting our own taste more.
And how do you find the right balance between getting weird and making it still feel cohesive with the rest of the line?
That's a good question. I mean, we do seasonal mood boards, so everything kind of goes back to the mood. So the line feels cohesive. The thing that we've actually struggled with, or like we're still kind of figuring out the relationship with, is a large part of our line is like core products that we refresh colors in, but a lot of it carries over. So how do you kind of like match that core offering of like, if you want a, you know, black canvas tote bag, you know, we always have that, with the like newness and kind of more seasonal feeling stuff.
One of the things that we spent time on was actually in the last conversation was about value and about some of these designs that you've had that, you know, the core standard bagu has been around now for over 10 years. You've been selling that same exact shape.
We're on year 13.
That's pretty incredible. And one of the questions that I was asking you at that point was, how do you design in terms of what are things that you hope are going to be around for the next 10 years versus deciding on products that maybe are more experimental or that you don't foresee like selling forever?
That's an interesting thing to talk about. So the thesis of our line is all the bags you need for everyday life. So I think we've really thought through what is the set of bags that, you know, with some like lifestyle variation, but like that our average customer needs to get through their everyday thing. Well, we started talking, like just looking at ourselves, like I went through and made a list of all of the baggy products that I have in that I'm like using in regular rotation. And I think for me, it was like there were like 28 different Baggu products that I use in any given week.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, I guess I'm like, we would hope that I'm the like number one evangelist of this stuff. But no, that was actually like what was going on in my home life was like, we just used, you know, we use a lot of bags. And then we went through and we interviewed kind of what we were calling our power users. So customers who had like really embraced the line and were using a lot of different parts of the line. And then in those interviews, talking to people about like, what bags are you using that aren't Baggu? Like where for us are the holes in the line? That's how most of the line came about, was just someone on the design team was like, oh, I'm going to do this thing and I need a bag and we don't make the right bag. So I had to go buy one somewhere else. We should really be making this. So yeah, I think like the products that hit on that like perfect blend of like function and delight are the ones that kind of do the best for us over the long term.
Here's a weird question. Maybe it's too meta, but one of the things that you've been talking about, both from a company value standpoint and your product process, has been coming back to what are the known knowns? What are the things that mm-hmm. we know about ourselves, about our products, and kind of being able to compartmentalize that and say like, okay, if at any point in time we get lost or confused, we could go back and look at that.
Right.
And then you've been experimenting at the same time with a lot of new things. You're trying a lot of new products and you're talking about mastery.
But everything new we're doing is still a bag.
Well, this is my question.
We're just mastering bags.
Okay, you're mastering bags. My question was going to be like, are you trying to master experimentation? Like, are you trying to master getting good at trying a lot of new things that still feel like the right thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. No, and design is so iterative. Yes, always.
What is an experiment for you right now that you have no idea how it's going to turn out?
I mean, all of our really good experiments I can't tell you about. They won't come out for another year.
Is there anything that was an experiment in the product lineup that people can look at that turned out successful, or things that maybe you had to toss out because they weren't working?
I think that fanny pack was a big experiment. We were like, are we a brand where people will wear our logo so visibly? Like, have we done a good enough job with the brand that people are like kind of proud to represent this brand? Because there are lots of brands that like you'd use their product, but you wouldn't wear like a t-shirt that says Kleenex, but like you'd still buy Kleenex.
Well, yeah. And Baggu, for the most part, has been, you know, kind of a no branding kind of brand. So that's a very big departure.
Yeah, it's true. And we've been like kind of quieter with our branding. That was a big question mark for us.
Did it work? What happened?
That product is so great. People love the way it looks. They wear it. They Instagram themselves wearing it. You can see the logo in their Instagram. It's like, it's all of the things combined.
Did anyone say anything about the fact that there's a big logo on it?
I mean, I think like the like zeitgeist of the moment is this kind of like street style logo mania, which yes, we're speaking to that. And the like, I don't know, long tail of that product might be like in a few years, the logo on that gets subtler. We're playing with a black on black version. But no, I mean, I feel like largely people have embraced that product.
It's always so fascinating to me how, you know, you always hear this, like it's easy to get in your own head and stuff. But sometimes the most fascinating business decisions are the one where internally, it feels like such a big deal. But then when you put it out there, nobody like reacts at all. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's totally fine.
No. And like, that's the best case scenario is like no reaction. The other experiment we just did was, so we've been searching forever for a really good quality of recycled nylon that we were able to, we buy a ton of nylon. So we needed like a stable supplier, like really stable quality. And we finally found one. And this last season that we released a couple weeks ago was the first time that we used the recycled nylon in all of our, the standard baggie and all of our ripstop nylon products. But in order to do that, the recycled nylon cost like way more than not recycled nylon. And we had to raise the price of that product by $2, which we were all kind of nervous about. But like going back to our values and like what we believe in and what we want to do as a brand and what our customers want out of like a reusable bag, they want it to be eco-friendly. Why else would they buy it? We decided that that was the right thing to do. I mean, it's an inexpensive product to begin with, but we've gotten almost no pushback about the price increase.
What else is new on the sustainability side?
Well, we are in the process of trying to do a more comprehensive sustainability program at Baggu. We're definitely not the scale that this is something we feel like we can invent from scratch. Sustainability is kind of very subjective and everybody has a different definition. So we kind of like want to find the definition that rings true to us and then be able to measure ourselves against that. So we're in the process of researching the existing standards out there and learning about how other companies who like we admire on a sustainability front are doing things. And so we're in the like discovery phase right now. And then hopefully at some point this year, we'll feel like we kind of like get what's out there and we'll pick something and then start rolling out a program to like get in compliance with the standard we choose. But I mean, that's kind of like, that's a really long-term thing. You see people's sustainability efforts and it's, you know, over like a 5-year time scale.
Yeah. One thing that we learned recently is kind of what you're saying, which is that every company defines sustainability slightly differently.
Yeah.
And that's something that is really challenging for us because we get a tremendous amount of questions from our customers or potential customers who want to make their packaging more sustainable. And we kind of had defined something for ourselves.
How did you guys define it? Because that's something we thought about with mailers a lot. Because it's like the poly bags have like the lowest shipping carbon footprint.
Yes.
And most, like a lot of stuff doesn't actually get recycled. So if it gets thrown into a landfill, it's like a really small footprint in a landfill. But it's plastic. And then the like paper mailers, it's like those are recyclable, but they weigh more. So if you're air shipping them, like your carbon footprint is higher in transit, but lower in the manufacturing of the product.
Yes. So
okay, so you tell me all the things because you know more about this than I do.
No, all of the above. The thing that we kind of landed on is the fact that we want to give people visibility around the data of what's happening and then help them make choices that fit with their point of view. Because mm-hmm. I think before we were trying to have maybe too much of a point of view, especially as a B2B company, we're trying to service, you know, other companies. And we'll have customers come in who say, for us, the most important thing is everything has to be plastic free.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a year ago, we would have been like, well, you know, but plastic in certain circumstances might be better. And there's like studies that have been done around this, but it also has its own trade-offs. And that whole explanation takes like 3 days to explain.
Yeah.
And so what we're trying to move towards is more allowing people to come at us with whatever their idea of sustainability is.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we're adding new things to our product catalog where you can filter by certain values that you have. If it's really important for you to have things that are compostable or plastic-free or, you know, made from renewable resources or made from recycled content. Like, what we're finding is that there are companies that I think do a really good job of choosing some of these standards and saying, like, we're just going to make it a thing that every product that we make that's made out of paper has to be FSC certified paper or something like that.
Yeah.
And so that's a choice that they've made. And we're trying to help make the platform responsive to those needs. And then through data, once they, this is kind of more long-term thinking, but once they start using those products and we can understand the actual manufacturing and transit carbon footprint that exists around those products, we can help them actually make decisions based on the actual usage. And then that's where you introduce ideas of, hey, maybe this is a better approach to solve this particular problem because everyone's supply chain is slightly different. Patagonia did a really great blog post that we talked about on the podcast with the writer of that blog post, Nellie Cohen, who works at Patagonia, explaining why they decided to stick with poly bags after trying a bunch of different other options.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so it's a really complicated.
We agonize about poly bags.
Yeah. It's the whole industry does. In fact, there was a really great article in, I think it was in Vox. We'll put a link in the show notes that kind of describes all of the agony of poly bags because it's a real struggle. If you're trying to balance all those different variables, it's very difficult to find something that performs as well as a poly bag.
Yeah, poly bags are just so like insignificant in a way.
The thing that I've landed on, and this is more, now I'm not speaking on Lumi's behalf and just for myself, is I do think that for me personally, I want this to be my legacy. Like as a human being, I want to move the world's manufacturing towards more sustainable means of production, more responsible means of production. And so we're awesome. Making that, we're just like, that is a huge, huge focus. But I kind of feel like Lumi is like a methadone clinic. Like uh-huh. we're trying to help people get off of these like non-sustainable ways of doing things, but in a more gradual way than having to go cold turkey and saying like, you know, your approach is wrong, which is a very like high-minded point of view.
Yeah, yeah. And also like something that only a very small percentage of people can like hear and functionally use.
Yeah.
Most people you'll just alienate with that approach and like they'll go somewhere else where someone's not saying that just to them.
Exactly. Hey, what's Super Bagu?
Super Bagu was an activation that we did, I think, once in 2017 and twice in 2018.
People have to see the photos of this thing. It's so cool.
Yeah, we made a fake grocery store with all of these like fake products. I feel like people were very interested in, there were milk cartons.
And eggs and stuff. Yeah.
And egg cartons. And the milk cartons did not have real milk in it because we did not put in refrigerators. It was non-dairy creamer and water. Wow. That was like the our most asked question was, is that real milk? But yeah, it was this kind of like beautiful art project, fake grocery store that sold Bagu products.
And you had it in some pop-up locations?
Yeah, we did it for West Coast Craft.
Okay.
And we did it down in LA at Poketo.
Yeah.
In the Row.
We'll put some photos of that too, but that was really cool. That must have been fun. How did that come about?
It was a really fun project. It started out as a display for West Coast Craft. We felt like we met a lot of people in San Francisco that didn't know that we were here and that we have an office here and a store here. So we wanted to kind of like get a little bit more involved with local stuff in San Francisco. So West Coast Craft seemed kind of like it's our target market and lots of people go there. So we were trying to think of something we could do at West Coast Craft that wouldn't feel like anything else at West Coast Craft, which, you know, no tarot cards, no sheepskins. nothing natural dyed. Actually, I love natural dyed stuff and sheepskins and tarot cards. But yeah, we were trying to come up with something that like wouldn't alienate people, but would seem really kind of like unique. And our thought of doing just like a corner store that I think we looked at a lot of the like Japanese 7-Elevens.
Right. I can tell.
But it was this super fun design project. And I think it got people really excited about the brand.
Well, last time we talked, you were saying that one of the things you were struggling with was merchandising the products in physical retail. So helping people understand that the bags are actually bags because they come yes. folded up and that there's these reusable grocery bags. And I feel like this art installation is like the opposite somehow. It's like somehow you've like taken the hardest problem about selling your products in physical retail and like inverted it and made a store where it explains the product by visually telling you that this is a thing that you can use in a grocery store. I don't know. It's very inside out. I like it.
Yeah, totally. We ended up solving some of those problems with packaging. We have there's a little cardboard sleeve with a photograph on the standard baggies now, and you can hang them on a slat wall.
And you know that worked for people? Like now it's like people understand what it is?
Yes. I think it's two steps forward.
Zero steps back?
Yeah. Well, we increased the amount of paper in the packaging by we used to have a hang tag and then we moved to a sleeve. Mm. So I think it's 50% more paper, which we use a recycled paper. I don't know. It's anytime you add more trash to a product, it kind of sucks. But yeah, we took out the little plastic hang tag attacher. So we're down a piece of plastic, added a tiny bit more paper. But in terms of it making the product look really beautiful and communicating to the customer what it is and making it not get messy in other people's stores, I would say we were solidly successful. But I do feel sad about the little bit more paper we're using. Packaging is hard.
I want to end on the last value out of the five that we talked about. We sort of alluded to it with the sustainability, but thinking long term, what does that mean to you outside of sustainability?
Mm. Well, I think in the way that we structure the company and what our kind of goals are year over year, we're thinking a lot about how we can add long-term equity to the brand, not just hit our monthly sales goals. And so we do an actual kind of annual planning process now where we're more deliberately choosing how much we want to grow each sales channel. Over the whole history of the company, the majority of our sales are from inbound interest. It's just people emailing us wanting to buy stuff or going to our website. And I think this last year is the first time we've been more deliberate about thinking through, we really want to grow this channel, and on these other channels, we want to focus on, quality of the stores that the bags appear in. But that's not a place where we want to, add dollars to revenue.
What is long-term in terms of years for you in your brain when you think long-term?
Wow. That's a crazy question. Okay, my just off-the-cuff answer is 10 years. Although, that's not even that long.
I was going to ask.
So maybe I'm full of shit.
Well, long 10 years is long in most business context.
But I feel like in life, it's not actually that long of a time.
Do you know the Long Now Foundation?
No.
Oh, my God. It's one of the charities that I love and support. It's actually based in San Francisco. It was started by Stuart Brand, who you might know his stuff. He did the Whole Earth Catalog. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. Mm, that's a big graphic inspiration for us.
The Long Now Foundation is basically a foundation about long-term thinking, but more on the scale of hundreds to tens of thousands of years. What is the human impact over that course of time? So they're doing all these crazy things. They're making a clock that's going to last 10,000 years and putting it inside of a mountain. They have a great podcast, actually, podcast recommendation, which is just the audio version of their talks that happen in San Francisco. It's called SALT. I think it's seminars about long-term thinking or something like that.
Whoa.
You should check it out. I think.
Okay, I'm going to try it out.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. They do cute things too on their website. Whenever they talk about years, they add an extra zero. So right now we're in 019 zero 2019. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's a thing that I've been kind of fascinated about recently as well. Just how can we expand the notion of time when we're making business decisions or even just your personal life decisions. Anyway, that's kind of a big topic to end on. Yeah. Oh,
yeah, it kind of blows my mind though.
Let's talk about it in another 18 months or something and see where we land. This was really fun.
Let's talk about it in 180 months.
If I'm still alive, I would love to have that conversation.
I know. How long is that? Yeah, just 18 months with no extra zero. Sounds good.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Yeah, it was lovely talking to you.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to, send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.